I had a pastor that that I studied under when I was studying for ordination, and he had a saying that he loved to say. He said, "The pulpit is the last bastion of uninterrupted speech in America." I want you to think about that for a second. Last bastion of uninterrupted speech in America. And to him, that was a really good thing because he hated to be interrupted, you know. And so he thought that was great. You know, I'm not quite so sure. When you have just one-way communication and there's no opportunity for feedback, there's no opportunity for questions, no opportunity for any sort of dialogue, there is a great opportunity for miscommunication and for laying things out there and they just don't quite connect, or there is a great opportunity for unintended interpretation. Let me put it that way. And you won't really know what's going on. You know, it's most readily seen in our culture now in email. You know, you send an email out. And I don't know about you, but I reread an email about 3 times before I press send, because I want to make sure that there is no way that this thing can be misconstrued. And I read each sentence and make sure it's clear, but mostly make sure that it can't be interpreted in a completely different way. And some of us like to use those little emoticons, I guess you call them, the little faces with the different expressions on them, or you have to turn sideways because they use the colon and the semicolon and the parentheses and all this stuff to try to get across some of the facial expressions and body language. I had a friend who was, if he was being ironic or sarcastic or facetious or something, he would put in brackets "grin," you know, so I know that he was smiling. But it's very difficult in that type of setting to send something off and have no idea how it's going to be received. And so in this last bastion of uninterrupted speech, I find the same thing going on. It's hard sometimes. I do see your faces, and I get some feedback, but you know, sometimes things can be misinterpreted. And so with that in mind, I do want to tell you that sometimes you do get tweaked, and that's something I'm actually trying to do. I am trying to tweak you to a certain extent. There's an old saw that goes that a good sermon is one that brings comfort to the uncomfortable and discomfort to those who are comfortable. And there's a certain truth to that. I know that we are so conditioned to hearing what we already understand, to hear what we already believe and think we know, that sometimes you got to get just tweaked a little bit off the center of your seat in order to know that you're hearing something new and different. And so my job here is to do that tweaking, to set something in enough different terms or strident enough tone that you realize that you're hearing something different, but not so much that you pick up a rock or walk out the door. And so, you know, with all of you having different centers of your targets out there, that's impossible to do. But, you know, I am trying to get that across. And, you know, sometimes I miscalculate. I do want you to know that Marion is your advocate, however. So when I miscalculate, when I go too far, I hear from her on the way home. It's a wonderful kind of check and balance that I think I have going. I remember at the last church I was at, you know, my study is in the Hebrew roots of Christianity, and so trying to get points across from a Hebrew point of view is something that I'm always trying to do. So, for instance, to know God is one of the central themes of the Old Testament and the New Testament. Ezekiel uses the term over 70 times in one book. Well, to know in Hebrew is to know experientially, intimately, and not just to know with your mind. And it's actually a euphemism for sexual relations. And so I get out there and I'm all excited to share with everybody that knowing God is like taking him into your tent and knowing him like Adam knew Eve. And I'm watching, and you know, Marion's jaws on her chest. They're just like, "Oh my gosh, did you really say that out loud?" You know, and I did. But trying to make the point, you know. I remember we were just in here just about a few months ago. We were talking about relationships and marriage. And I think I made a comment something along the lines of, if you're 40 and never been married, there's a reason for that. And, of course, Marion was sitting right next to somebody who was 40 and never married. So I got to hear about that one, too. And You know, I almost said that I hate emoticons, you know, and I was just talking about that, but then some of you love emoticons. And so all of this is difficult because, you know, everybody has such different tastes and sensibilities and all these things going on, and we're trying to communicate here in a deeper way than just a casual communication or just a rehashing of the things that we think we already know. And so last week, we were talking about camping outside the gates of Eden. And what that means for those of you who missed the last couple of weeks or so is that there are times in our life where we get stuck. God is always calling us to something deeper, always calling us to the next level of relationship, which, coincidentally, is always calling us out of our comfort zone, out of the things that we always know. It always feels like a risk. It always feels scary. But He's calling us. And we can't go back the way we came, just as Adam and Eve couldn't go back to the garden because the gate was barred by the angels with the flaming swords. And if you're too afraid to go forward and you can't go back, you stay just camped outside of Eden. And the fears that are keeping us stuck are not only personal fears, but they're macro fears, the fears out there. And we talked about the condition of the world and how scary it is out there, how quickly things are changing, how people are thinking maybe it's the end times because how much worse can it possibly get? And all of these things are weighing on us. And then we looked at the original church, the first century church, and how they dealt with a situation that was very similar in terms of the social setting, in terms of the fears that the people had, the uprootedness that they felt, and that their solution was to turn toward each other in God's Spirit. It was really a social experiment as much as it was a theology or a religion. They met in each other's homes. The richer folk would even sell their property and bring it and lay it on the table, and the apostles and the eventual deacons would divide it all up. And it started to sound like a tithing message, you know, like what I was telling you is like, hey, everybody, go sell everything and bring it back and lay it at Frank's feet because he's going to distribute it, you know. And nothing could be further from the truth. It wasn't about that, you know. And I wanted to make that point strongly then, and I want to make it again now, because what we tend to do is to compare ourselves to others. We compare ourselves against a standard. We compare ourselves against people we know, people in the media, people in the Bible. We're always comparing, and the church has made an art of this, let's be honest, over the last 2,000 years, to hold us to a certain standard, to constantly be comparing us and using the guilt that ensues in order to modify our behavior. And that's what's been going on. We do it to ourselves. It's done to us. We're constantly comparing. Now, it's one thing to have role models, but it's another thing to be living constantly under the burden of comparison. And that comparison can be absolutely debilitating as we go through. Another thing that pastor told me, or actually was one of his maxims, was that you never use your personal life as a sermon illustration. Well, I've broken that lots of times, and I'm going to break it again this morning, you know. He also said you should never use a dictionary definition in your sermon. And he also said you always put the pens down, and he said a lot of things, and I've broken them all. But when it comes to doing things wrong, I have a large repertoire to share with you, and so that's what I want to do. You know, I have in my life made so many mistakes and gone through the consequences of that, and this notion of comparison, whether we're comparing our church to the early church, our church to another church, and ourselves to each other, has caused me no end of grief. I remember coming out of high school being completely and totally paralyzed. And I don't know if any of you had that same experience, but I had no idea what I was going to do. If you look at my yearbook under my name, it says, you know, we all wrote as seniors what we wanted to do. I had oceanographic science. What? You know, I don't even know why I was thinking that. Go out and swim with the dolphins? What was I thinking? You know, and I had no idea what to do. I was completely stuck outside the gates of my particular Eden at that time, which didn't feel like Eden at all. And I was afraid to go forward. The Marines were after me. I had good grades. And so the Marines contacted me. I think I was a National Merit Finalist or something. So I don't know how they got my name. They called me. I remember going down to the recruiting office, and they were giving me the hard sell. And the Marines, you know, now that would be pretty scary, too. Now, I often wonder what would have happened if I would have taken them up on it. But I didn't. What I was thinking about at the time was anything that could give me some sort of comfort. you know, some sort of sense of belonging. And there were two monks that taught me. I went to a Catholic high school. There were two monks that taught me, and they were kind of father figures, but really they were more like big brother figures because both of them were in their 20s. And one was Brother Ed, and the other one was Brother Kowaleski. We called him Ski. And they kind of took me under their wing. One of them was my drama teacher. We were doing plays and such. And I'll never forget him telling me at one point, you know, if you think you're going to look stupid, you will. So no matter how stupid you think it is, just go for it. Full on immersion. And I learned that from him. Brother Ski, one of the greatest things he ever told me was, is that any man is capable of the utmost folly at any given moment. I carry these things with me. But most importantly, when I was having a really bad time at 2 o'clock in the morning, I remember several times going and throwing rocks against Brother Ski's window and waking him up because they lived in a community house on the campus. I knew he didn't have a wife. I knew he didn't have children. He was really there for us guys. It was an all-guy school. And he'd come down into the parlor, and we'd sit, and we'd talk. And I can still see that little ugly room with its walls. And there were times when he would get in my face. I remember one time being completely depressed, and he said, "If you don't smile, I'm going to kick your butt." Only he didn't say butt. And I didn't, and he did. And he was a wrestling coach, so he knew how to do it. He got me on the floor, and he kicked me, you know. And it was what I needed at the moment. And what I did was I wanted to be them. I wanted to be like them. I wanted to be able to do for another kid what they were doing for me. And I was comparing my life to theirs, so I joined the order. You know? Marine, monk. Marine, monk. You know? Okay. So I became a monk. At least I went to the House of Formation. But I realized almost immediately I couldn't do what they do. I was trying to fit my life into their peg hole. And it wasn't fitting. And so I quit, and I came home after a certain amount of time. And then I threw myself into music. And there was a kid who was a year ahead of me in high school. His name was Manny Lopez, and he was one of the most popular guys on the campus. Hispanic, but big old fro, you know, which is really cool in the early 70s. And this guy was a type of just easy personality. He just kind of glided everywhere he went. There was just this natural ease and smile to him. And I wanted to be Manny, you know. And Manny joined a troupe called Up With People and was touring all over the nation and all over the world. And he came into our town, and I went to see him, and I wanted to do what he did. And so I went up, and I talked to him, and I talked. And so I got accepted into the cast, and everybody knew that I was Manny's friend. And since he was a dancer, they figured I was going to be a dancer too. Big mistake. They found out as soon as they got me in that choreography room in Tucson, okay, we got to put him someplace else. You know? But I wanted to be Manny. I saw his life. I saw the way he was. I saw what he did. And I wanted to do that too. There was a kid in the traveling troupe with me who was from Britain. And his name was Bruce Harris. And we became fast friends. And after the tour ended, we stayed friends afterwards. And he went to school in New Hampshire or someplace and got a degree in international management and then worked for Covenant House. And then he worked for Save the Children. Meanwhile, I had gotten involved with Children of the Americas, which I'm still involved with now, which was a similar organization working with kids in Central and South America. But he was down in a city called Ciudad Obregón on the mainland, on the west coast of Mexico. And he invited me down there, so I went down for 2 to 3 weeks with him to see what he was doing and to see what was going on. And I admired Bruce. I got down to Mexico. He was already speaking fluent Spanish. Here he is, a Brit, and he's speaking fluent Spanish with hardly a trace of accent. And he's managing all this stuff. He takes me out to the middle of the Sonoran Desert, to a school there that was primarily set up for Guatemalan refugees. At the time, in the early 80s, there was a civil war in Guatemala, and they were pouring across the southern border, and he was working with all these kids. And the headmaster of the school asked me if I would stay on as an English teacher. By this time, I had my degree in English literature and creative writing. And I said, "But I don't speak Spanish." He says, "I don't care. We want you to be, just have the kids immersed." And I had to actually come to grips with what that would mean. Going down to Mexico, living in this remote area where the only fuel was going out into the desert and picking up mesquite logs that were dried out. And living there in these conditions. And what I realized was I was trying to be Bruce. Bruce was a true citizen of the world. He came from Britain, but he was just as home in the United States and Mexico. He eventually worked in South America. He didn't have a real sense of place. It didn't bother him to be completely removed from anything that was familiar. He thrived on it, as a matter of fact. Last thing I heard about Bruce, he had gotten so involved in the politics, especially the politics of trafficking children, that he was getting on the wrong side of a lot of ugly powers, and his house was actually strafed by machine gun fire. You know, that was the level to which he took it. And I really beat myself up for a long time about not being able to go down there because I refused the offer. I realized I'm not Bruce. I can't do what Bruce does. As much as I wanted to, as much as I thought that that would be fulfilling, comparing myself to all of these people as I went through. You know. Later on, I wanted to be Peter Gabriel. I wanted to sing like him. I wanted to write like him. You know, it was just one thing after another, just going through all of these people. And now, sitting here in this church, you know, it's also natural to compare our church to other churches. You know, Mike was talking about going over to a mega church in Irvine, and where they got, you know, it looks like airport terminals in there, you know, big screens everywhere and stainless steel, this and that, and fountains and waterfalls. And then, you know, then there's our place. You know, it's so natural to do these comparisons and to see yourself on the short end, a long end, you know, flipping channels and you see all the TV preachers and you go by and I have to stop for a while and, you know, well, I could do that, maybe. I don't know. You know, you can't help but compare. I'll tell you what, every time I come past Joel Osteen, I have to listen for at least 10 minutes to that guy. I don't know how he does it, but if you ever listen to him, he never, ever flubs a single word. How does he do that? You know? Does he write everything down and memorize it? You know? I don't see any teleprompters. The guy just amazes me. I don't know how he pulls that stuff off. Why? Why do we do this? More recently, I was doing some research on Dietrich Bonhoeffer. I don't know if you've ever heard of him. He's a German Lutheran pastor. He was ordained in 1927, and he was a Wunderkind, you know, just this child prodigy. Got his doctorate at 21 in theology from the University of Berlin. And he was too young to even be ordained. He couldn't be ordained until he was 25. So he spent time in Spain, he came to the United States and spent time in Harlem and got involved with, you know, the black church there and the social justice that really envelops, you know, black Christianity. Went back to Germany, finally got ordained just in time for the Nazis to take power in 1933, which radically changed everything in his life. On the day the Nazis took power, on the day that Hitler was made chancellor, he was on the radio denouncing Hitler. He got shut off in mid-sentence, if you can imagine. And he became more and more vocal because Hitler not only was taking over government, he started to take over the church, too. He appointed his own presbyters and his own leaders, and he was changing the church, and the church was going along with it. You know, it was an established church, a state-run church. And Bonhoeffer was one of the ones who was fighting that, actually creating a church called the Confessing Church. You know, and working. And then in 1939, just before the war broke out, he came back to the United States and realized, though, it was a mistake. He was on all of the enemies' list. He was disallowed from preaching, disallowed from writing, and all of his friends were urging him to stay in the United States because if he went back, he was in grave danger. And he said, look, if I'm going to be any part of the reconstruction of my church and my country, I can't not go through this with them. And so he came back, and he became involved in the German resistance, and he became involved not directly, but in some of the plots to assassinate Hitler, and he had to work with that through his own grief, you know, and his own beliefs, because he was a pacifist, yet he knew that Hitler had to be stopped. And then eventually he was arrested, and 3 weeks before the Soviets took Berlin, he was hanged and executed as an enemy of the state. A month before Germany capitulated and surrendered. You hear a story like that, you hear a life like that, and I don't know, it just can't help but make your life feel smaller by comparison, right? It's just what happens, it's what we do to ourselves. But the key here is not to try to become Bonhoeffer. I mean, his life was a unique intersection of his desires, his talents, and history. You know, he didn't have any choice as to who was going to take power in his country. It happened. He was a person with the right training and the right mind, the right desire at the right time, and he acted decisively. Each one of us is going to have our own unique intersection of our desires, of our talents, of our training, and the history that we are part of. Somehow we have to stop seeing our lives as some sort of mold that we need to fit into, something that we need to compare ourselves to, and start to just let ourselves be. You know, it's like that child we were talking about earlier. If we can let our lives just envelop us and immerse ourselves into them, out of that connection that we feel with each other, with God, is going to come a desire for something. And the desire that preceded the longing to just be together is part of this whole thing too. What is it going to look like when our desire actually motivates us to action? See, these are all questions that we need to answer somehow. But I'll tell you what, it's hard enough just being myself without trying to be someone else too. I don't have the energy for that anymore. I'm exhausted. You know, I was exhausted. I'm getting much better at being okay in my own skin, but I'm not perfect about it. And probably none of us are. And again, that guilt gets laid on too. Look at this verse here at Mark 12, 41 to 44. This is a story that you've heard a million times. It's called the widow's mite, you know, usually, even though there was no such thing as a mite in Jesus' day. But Jesus is sitting in the temple and he's teaching, and he sits opposite the treasury and he watches people coming in and putting in their tithes and offerings into the receptacles there. And a woman comes in and puts in two tiny, small, either bronze or copper coins. They're called pruta in Hebrew. They were worth less than a cent. It was the smallest denomination that you could have or own. And Jesus comments, he says, "Truly I say to you, this poor widow put in more than all the contributors to the treasury. For they all put in out of their surplus, but she, out of her poverty, put in all she owned, all she had to live on." All right, now you want the guilt to set in? Oh my gosh, she put in everything she had to live on. What have I done lately, you know? And that's the way we've used this. I mean, look what she did, you know? Again, remember that all she had to live on for that day. You got paid daily back then. It was hand to mouth, especially at this level. So maybe she fasted that day. Maybe she put that in. Who knows what the situation was? The interesting thing is that Jesus doesn't even really commend her. Do you notice that? Read it again. He doesn't say she's near to the kingdom. He doesn't say, look how wonderful a thing she's done. He doesn't say, imitate her. He just comments. It may be more that he was commenting that she was being abused. Because the line right before it is talking about how the Pharisees devour the widow's salaries and the widow's money. So maybe he was saying the church shouldn't expect that of people. Who knows what he was saying? But the fact remains that she put in what she had to give at the time. That's it. What do we have to give at the time? Can we become a people that becomes sensitized enough to each other, to what's going on around us, that we simply feel a need when we see it? And it doesn't have to be money. What if what is required is simply a smile as you're passing someone on the street that changes their outlook for that day? What if what somebody needs is simply a shoulder to cry on for half an hour, 45 minutes, an ear to listen? What if what someone needs is a job, a hand, a helping hand to do whatever? To be the kind of person, regardless of income, regardless of status, regardless of our ability or what we think we can or can't do, to be the person who simply sees a need and responds to it, is what Jesus is trying to get to us. What we give, how much we give, doesn't matter. Size doesn't matter. It just doesn't matter. It's not about that. Jesus says it so eloquently here at Matthew 5:4. Blessed are those who mourn, for they shall be comforted. What does that have to do with what we're talking about? But when you look at the words there for mourn and comfort in Hebrew Aramaic, it starts to change things for us. The word for mourn, ebal, you know, it means literally to be kind of twisted inside. It means confused. It means to be wandering. But more importantly, it means to be deeply longing for something to occur. Think about that for a second. Deeply longing for something to occur. When you are mourning for something, either for yourself, for someone else, for something that's happening, you're deeply longing for something to occur. When that longing, when that desire actually moves you to action, goes from being an academic thought in your brain to being a choice that you make, something that you actually physically do, then you move to the next section, baya netbayun, which means comfort, but it means it in another specific way. It means literally to see the arrival of, to see the face of, that for which you are deeply longing. And we think, oh, if I am mourning, if I have compassion, if I care for someone, then at some point in the future, I'm going to be comforted. God is going to comfort me. Maybe it's in the next life. And what Jesus is saying is, no, it's immediate. It's right here and right now. The decision to move out because of your desire, because of your longing, is your comfort. It is that thing. It all happens at once. It's a closed circuit. It's instantaneous. The connection, the desire, the unity with the other is the comfort that we seek. That was the whole point of talking about the first century church last week. The church faced the fears, both micro within its members and macro with the Roman world outside, by connecting with each other in such a way that their desire motivated them to do something, to float everyone's boat higher. And in the process of doing that, guess what happened? They weren't so afraid anymore because they had each other. And they had the sense of God's presence empowering them, His Spirit empowering them in the doing of all of this. And they were able to face their world together. This is what is possible for us if we can start to get this notion out of our head that there's not something outside of ourselves that we have to hold ourselves to, compare ourselves with, become, you know? It's not out there someplace. The kingdom is within. Finding that place of desire that takes us to the place of action is the comfort we seek, is the connection we seek. Frank and a whole group of guys went to a concert on Friday night. In fact, they had to leave early from the soak, which we weren't too happy about, but we let them go. And they went to see the Crash Test Dummies. Are any of you familiar with this group? All right, I see. Okay. I really wasn't. You know, I didn't know about them. And I said, who is this group you're blowing us off for to go see? And he was trying to explain to me about the Crash Test Dummies. And yesterday morning, as I was prepping for today, I get an email from him. He says, you got to listen to this song. And he says, I think you could do a whole sermon on this song. And yeah, you probably could. But it certainly, as I was reading the lyric, it just struck me. It was right in line with what we're talking about right now. And I had to put it in here. And you're probably thinking I'm nuts if you've read ahead and looked at this thing, because it's the most bizarre thing in the world. But humor me for a minute. Bear with me for just a second. And listen to this. This is called God Shuffled His Feet. After 7 days, he was quite tired. So God said, let there be a day just for picnics with wine and bread. He gathered up some people he had made, created blankets, and laid back in the shade. The people sipped their wine, and what with God there, they asked him questions like, do you have to eat or get your hair cut in heaven? And if your eye got poked out in this life, would it be waiting up in heaven with your wife? And God shuffled his feet and glanced around at them. The people cleared their throats and stared right back at him. So he said, once there was a boy who woke up with blue hair. To him it was a joy until he ran out into the warm air. He thought of how his friends would come to see and would they laugh or had he got some strange disease. And the people sat waiting out on their blankets in the garden, but God said nothing. So someone asked him, I beg your pardon, I'm not quite clear about what you just spoke. Was that a parable or just a subtle joke? And God shuffled his feet and glanced around at them, and the people cleared their throats and stared right back at him. What? I'll probably hear about this one from Marion too later. You know, what struck me about this is that on first glance it seems to make no sense. I mean, it's just this strange collection of thoughts. But you know what? Think about it. Isn't this the way we experience life? We are always looking for direct answers to direct questions that will direct us in such a way that we think somehow we can get rid of the risk in our lives, that we can have a clear path that's going to lead us from here to there, that we can just be like this or just be like that. First century church, you know, the TV pastor, whoever it is in your life that you admire, that you want to be like, if you could just have that, if you could just have this answer, if I could just know about heaven, if I can just know about fill in the blank here, if I could have answers to these questions, then I could move out. Then I wouldn't be afraid anymore. Then I could go do the things that this guy is doing, and my life would be fulfilled. I will have meaning and purpose. And God just shuffles his feet and looks at us because we've got this uneasy relationship with him. We're going to him for the wrong things. We're going to him for specific answers that in this life we're just not going to get. And so when he finally speaks, we don't understand. And he says, you know what? If you wake up with blue hair, enjoy your hair. If you wake up in certain circumstances, enjoy your circumstances. Live them. And you know what? Just like Peter, when he first stepped out of the boat and stood on the surface tension of the water, he was okay for a second until what? And still he started to look around and analyze and think about it. What will the neighbors say? You know, what is going on here? What will they think? And you start comparing yourself again. And everything that you are feeling, that momentary lifting of your spirit, that momentary joy, release, finally just being okay inside your skin is gone. That baby laying on the floor there, just accepting what was washing over him. If we could do the same thing with our blue hair and all of the baggage that we carry and the circumstances we find ourselves in, it'll be all right. We can do this. But if we keep looking for the answers in places where they will not come, we're going to get lost again. I don't know what this songwriter had intended by this lyric. I don't know if I'm getting it, if I'm reading too much into it. But you know what? This is what I got from it today. And it's valid too, because it's speaking to me. It's adding another layer on top of this whole thing that makes me more and more convinced that this is the way that we're supposed to live. This is what kingdom is all about. We don't need to compare ourselves to another. What we need to do is to become a people that are just so entranced in the moment, immersed in the moment, that we can respond to whatever is needed. And we don't have to worry about what anyone else is doing. Keep our eyes fixed on the Lord and keep our hearts fixed in the moment, and life will be good. Let's pray. Father, I am grateful for the moments of peace that you have given me. I'm grateful for them as a touchstone in my life. That when I fall back off the wagon and I start looking around me and dragging myself back down into that well, that you've given me something I can hold on to now. You've given me a principle in my life, an experience in my life that I can return to, an experience of you, without words, beneath words, without thoughts, above thoughts, just a place where you and I can be together, and a place from which I can actually see the person in front of me. Thank you for that, Lord. Help us to cultivate those moments. Help us to string them together so that we can be characterized by your kingdom. We can live there, and we can love there, and we can find you and lose our fear, find our meaning and purpose. Thank you, Lord. In Jesus' name, amen. Amen.